This podcast was produced at Red Hat and is distributed under a Creative Commons license. We hope you enjoy this presentation and share it with others.
So let's talk about motivations for DRM.
First one is to stop infringement, or at least reduce it.
When you're doing a computer security analysis of something, you often talk about the threat model. That's sort of the definition of what it is you're trying to stop.
So there's the P2P threat model. This is the idea that what you're trying to do with your DRM is prevent your content from being redistributed on peer-to-peer via peer-to-peer file sharing. So this is a very, very difficult threat to stop. You would have to make a DRM scheme which is strong enough to prevent anyone anywhere, at least from who wants to, from stripping the DRM off. And nobody has succeeded. Nobody's gotten anywhere close to this level of effectiveness, technical effectiveness in DRM. So if your goal is to keep stuff off the P2P networks, you're not going to succeed. Even though a lot of the political rhetoric about DRM is about this, the fact is it's pretty clear that as a technical matter, DRM is not going to work against peer-to-peer, the peer-to-peer threat. There's also the so-called casual copying threat model. Here the idea is that what you're trying to stop is the consumer who wants to make a copy for their friend. Right? Someone has a DVD, they want to make a disk-to-disk copy and give it to their brother, give it to their neighbor. It's small-scale stuff done by individual users. You're not looking at somebody who's sophisticated and is going to distribute a zillion copies of it. You're talking about an ordinary person making a small number of copies. Here, at least, you have the advantage that if 20% of the users can break your DRM, you still are going to do some good. Then the other 80% may be unable to do casual copying, and if that casual copying is infringement, and if you think it's hurting your business, then you can actually achieve something. So if this is your threat, then there's some hope that DRM might be able to do some good to reduce the amount of infringement. The other use of DRM in practice is to control non-infringing private use. Rather than selling a song, for example, or a movie to a consumer, rather than selling a song to a consumer in a format where they can use it on any device, they can download it into portable music players, stream it to themselves over the net, play it, and et cetera, the publisher who's using DRM wants to be able to monetize those individual uses. They want to be able to charge extra for downloading into an iPod. They want to be able to charge per view for a movie rather than just selling it once. In general, they want to be able to use more complicated pricing and business models. And in order to do that, they use DRM to control private use so that private uses, non-infringing private uses, can't be made or can't easily be made except by coming to them and operating through their technology. Another purpose of DRM in practice is to control device design. We saw this with DVDs, for example, where the DRM technology, one of the things it did is it forced would-be makers of DVD players to come to the DVD CCA and take a license, both because the DRM technology might have patents. There could be patents associated with the DRM technology. There could be trade secrets, and you have the DMCA. So in the case of DVD, you had this interlocking combination of patents plus the DRM plus the DMCA, all of this designed to force would-be player makers to sign a contract with the DVD CCA, and then that contract limits how you can build DVD players. So control over device design is one of the things that DRM can give the DRM vendor. But there are other reasons to want to control device design. One of them is simply that you get the right to charge a tax to anyone who wants to build a device. The other is that you get to shape the market in the device. If you get to control what the devices can be compatible with, if there's some other technology coming along you don't like, you can mandate that the devices in your system can't be compatible with that. So you get to decide how this entire format, which really means sort of this entire industry sector, is going to respond to different disruptive technologies that come along. And this is certainly part of the motivation for DRM. DRM is one of the ways that content owners can get some control over what technology companies do. And finally, the natural consequence of this is limiting competition. You might think that the technology companies, the companies that make DVD players, are to some extent victims of the DVD CCA and that they're put in this situation where they have to license in order to be in their business. On the other hand, it's awfully hard to be an upstart DVD player
maker, right? The market is disciplined. There are certain kinds of innovation that can't happen, certain kinds of challenges to the companies that are in the system that can't happen. And just like there's this phenomenon that happens with regulation where the incumbent companies in the field are good at, maybe they're good at doing their technology, but one of the things they're good at is dealing with the regulation. And upstarts are not as good at dealing with the regulatory environment. So to some extent, the incumbents, the existing dominant companies in an industry sector may actually be in favor of having complicated regulation. And so to the extent that this is complicated regulation, the people who are already inside the tent may be happy to have it exist. If all the DVD players got together in a room and said, we are not going to, well, let's say all the makers of digital video recorders got together in a room and said, we're not going to have a commercial skip feature. We're not going to have a particular feature. The antitrust authorities would look skeptically on that. That's an agreement not to compete along some dimension. But if they call it a DRM standard, it's a DRM standards meeting, they can get together and have a discussion. And as long as there's some story about how it's needed for piracy, this is important. So one of the things that's important to recognize about even the industry processes about DRM is you hear a lot about this, stopping infringement, you hear some about this, but in fact, all of this stuff is going on. Especially in Washington, you shouldn't necessarily believe that that the reasons people have for taking a position match the story they tell about what they are trying to achieve. Right? Jack Valenti talked endlessly about this. He was, I think, more interested in this, controlling non-infringing private use and controlling device design and practice. The internationalization of all of this is a pretty interesting topic. One of the issues here is legal, right? In the U.S., we have a certain legal regime. We have the DMCA and so on. And the U.S. government has been working really hard to try to export the DMCA to as many countries as they can. The way this tends to work these days is through trade agreements. You have some trade agreement announced with some country, and the trade agreement requires, among other things, that country to implement some DMCA-like law. We've basically seen this happen over and over, and it's one of the assigned jobs of the U.S. trade representative in practice, is to get other countries to adopt U.S.-style intellectual property law, including things like DMCA. So this brings us to the question of what's the question of impact on open source overall of DRM. And certainly one of the big issues is has to do with the modifiability of open source software. A lot of DRM systems in there require one of two things. Some DRM systems require, that is, I mean, not the system itself, I mean this sort of licensing or regulatory structure around it, say the contract you have to sign with the DVD-CCA or some group like that, or where it's a legal or regulatory mandate, the law or regulation, requires that certain information be kept secret. That there be, say, some decryption key which is kept secret. Sometimes the algorithm that's used to decrypt or process something is supposed to be kept secret. If there's a watermark, perhaps the algorithm for decoding the watermark might be required to be kept secret. And it's hard to keep the algorithm or the data secret when your source code is open. So there's a question as to whether open source software can comply with those kinds of secrecy requirements. The other challenge has to do with so-called robustness rules. And robustness is the code word that DRM lawyers use to refer to restrictions on modifiability of technologies. So I talked before about how the broadcast flag had these rules that said that it had to be sufficiently difficult to modify the technology. There can't be an easy way to modify it to disable or defeat or work around the DRM. And so to the extent that there are rules that say that it has to be hard to modify the technology or hard to modify it in certain ways, then again, open source can be at a disadvantage. Because not only is it inherently easier to modify open source product, it's also one of the advantages of open source, obviously, that it is modifiable. And so those requirements of those sort of secrecy requirements of the systems have secrets or be hard to modify, I think, are the biggest direct impacts on open source in particular. There's a whole other set of issues that have to do with the impact on minority players in the market, players that are not dominant or have relatively small market share, which we can talk about as well. But the open source issues, I think, have to do with this modifiability. Now, maybe it's possible to deal with some of those by sectioning off part of the implementation into a sort of black box, which is not as open You might be able to, in the case of a DVD decryption, for example, have a little module which does the necessary stuff and is somehow closed, difficult to reverse engineer. The rules tend to say things like it cannot be possible, or it cannot easily be possible, or it cannot be possible for an ordinary user to modify the software in certain ways using ordinary tools. Where ordinary tools mean screwdrivers, and so on. It doesn't mean oscilloscopes. And in the case of software, usually it does not include debuggers. So, for example, the broadcast flag rules, I should say, in writing these robustness rules, there often is a sensitivity to the open source issue. In coming up with the broadcast flag rules, the FCC did look at the status of open source, and there were people arguing actively that open source implementations ought to be allowed, and the FCC said that they thought it would be good to have open source implementations allowed. They didn't get far enough in their rulemaking to actually sort of lay down in detail what the rules were going to be, what precisely the robustness rules were going to be. But it's, I think, challenging at least to figure out how to have robustness rules that have any kind of teeth at all but still are consistent with open source. So I think that's an issue which will continue to crop up. Generally, in debates over these sorts of technology mandates, the issue of open source is discussed. You see, you know, paragraphs in the rulemaking documents saying that we want to protect open source, that it's important that open source implementations be possible. But because none of these mandates has really gone all the way through to have a fully specified, complete rule laid down by the regulatory agency, we don't know exactly what they would do in practice. And I think it's worth worrying and worrying a lot about whether open source just gets lip service in this process or whether there actually is an opening.
The podcast you have just heard is distributed under version 2.5 of the Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works Creative Commons license. For more on this license, see creativecommons.org. For more podcasts and further information on Red Hat, visit redhat.com. Thanks for listening.